KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The council is also looking at whether existing marijuana businesses in Pioneer Square should be grandfathered in to any zoning regulations. A statewide citizens initiative legalized recreational marijuana in November. A writer at the Seattle Times called for a celebrity to help secure the release of a Linwood man from prison in North Korea, and yesterday he responded. Dennis Rodman is a flamboyant former star of the NBA and a current star of reality TV. Rodman tweeted a plea yesterday for the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to cut Kenneth Beth loose. Beth was sentenced last week to 15 years hard labor. North Korea has accused Beth of plotting to overthrow its government. Friends have said he's a devout Christian and that he had recently been living in China. Seattle Times writer Tan Tan called on Rodman because of the friendship he's publicized with the man he calls Kim. A media company hired Rodman last year to visit North Korea and filmed him having dinner and watching a basketball game with Kim Jong-un. Yesterday, President Barack Obama said the days are over when North Korea could create a crisis and elicit concessions. Rodman has said he plans to go back to North Korea in August. This is KUOW News. I'm Jamala Henderson.
Support for NPR comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas in gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com. Well, it's cloudy in Seattle, 54 degrees, but like yesterday, it's expected to turn sunny this afternoon, and we're going to get up into the low 70s. Then partly cloudy overnight with a low of 53. Tomorrow, clouds in the morning, sun in the afternoon, and a high of 75.
Support for KUOW comes from the litigation group at the law firm of Ryan, Swanson, and Cleveland.
KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org, I'm Marcy Silman. Good Wednesday to you. Coming up later this morning, our regular midweek guests, Vaughn Palmer, Robert Horton, and Michael Parks join us. Also coming up, the impact of head injuries on hormone levels and what that means. But first, Secretary of State John Kerry was in Moscow yesterday. He met with Russian officials to talk about their support for the Syrian government and to try to figure out a way to end the crisis in Syria. His trip was intended to seek another path besides military involvement by the U.S. in that country. The result, Russia and the United States are going to convene an international conference, and according to the New York Times, that could happen within a couple of weeks. Joining me now to talk more about what might happen next in Syria is Dr. Stephen Cook. He's the Hasib J. Sabbagh Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, great pleasure to be with you, Marcy.
Well, I guess let's start with John Kerry's travel to Russia yesterday. Russia, as I understand it, is Syria's biggest ally. So what was the initial intent of that trip?
Well, Russia, along with Iran, are Syria's biggest supporters. The intent was of Secretary Kerry's visit when it came to Syria was to find some way towards a political solution to this conflict. I think the Obama administration has, from the start, been reluctant to get deeply involved in Syria, and I think that there's been an estimation on the part of the administration that neither side is likely to win this war, and without some sort of diplomatic solution, this will drag on for a very long time and kill many, many more people.
As I understand it, the intent is for Syrian representatives to attend that international conference, correct?
That's correct.
And do you believe that that's going to happen?
Well, I'm deeply skeptical that either the rebels or the regime are willing to negotiate with each other. There was a time early on in the uprising where that seemed like a possibility, but after 80,000 people have been killed and millions have been pushed out of their homes and are made refugees, it strikes me that the rebellion is unwilling to contemplate any kind of political solution that requires the participation of the Assad regime, if not Bashar al-Assad himself. And from the perspective of Assad and his supporters, they are battling terrorists, and they have not, till this point, indicated that there's anything to negotiate. In fact, the Assad regime's strategy has been, from the very start, to fight its way out of the problem that it finds itself in.
You talk about the rebels as if it's a singular group. It's not, as I understand it, correct?
Indeed, the rebels being plural. There are many different factions of the Syrian rebellion, different groups that fall under a broad-based and not entirely unified opposition political movement, as well as a Free Syrian Army that is not as unified as one would, as the name suggests.
We're talking about the situation in Syria with Dr. Stephen Cook. And seriously, for somebody who's a layperson trying to follow what's going on, the situation changes not just day to day, but hour to hour. Yesterday, we understand that both internet, any kind of internet connections to the outside world were shut down. Some speculate by the Syrian government. Everybody blames everything on the Syrian government. I'm not sure if that's true. What does it mean that outside connection to the world was closed off?
Well, I think that most people were blaming the regime for cutting the internet and the and cell phone service, primarily because the Syrian government's the only one who has the capability to actually do that. Plus, there is precedent for this. Before major offensives throughout the 2 years of this bloody conflict, the regime has essentially removed Syria from the internet and cellular networks in order to prosecute the war as it would like, without information getting out to the rest of the world. That's a bit harder now that the United States has provided things like satellite telephones to groups within the rebellion. But nevertheless, the fact that the internet and the cell service was shut down in Syria did not augur well. It was an ominous sign that the regime was looking to press on the battlefield. And in fact, there are reports that they are trying. There's a major offensive underway to try to reverse rebel gains in the southern part of the country.
Two major other events happened. One is the Israeli airstrike on Sunday, our time. And the things that I've read indicate that what that has done is just whip up anti-Israel fervor and sort of muddied the waters for the Obama administration diplomatically.
Well, I'm not sure that there is a tremendous amount of anti-Israel fervor. Certainly, the Assad regime and the Iranians have been saber-rattling over this, along with their allies, Hezbollah. But you haven't really seen an outpouring of outrage in other Arab capitals. Of course, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood and the Syrian opposition itself issued carefully worded statements. But by and large, there wasn't this kind of whipping up of anti-Israel sentiment along the lines that we have seen before. But in fact, the Israelis have grown increasingly concerned about the transfer of sophisticated rocket technology and potentially chemical weapons from the Syrians to Hezbollah. And the first strikes actually came on Friday, and were targets at Damascus International Airport, which had come directly from Iran, weaponry that had come directly from Iran and that were destined for Hezbollah. The Israelis have always maintained that they will prevent that from happening, and that has also been a standing policy of the United States. So it does certainly complicate the mix here. The Obama administration has never really seen any resolution to this problem other than a political one, and certainly the Israelis won't be a party to that.
The other interesting speculation is that at least one rebel group had access and used chemical weapons sarin. In other words, it wasn't just the Syrian government using chemical weapons, but possibly Syrian rebels. The Obama administration denies that. Carla Del Ponte speaking internationally, I think is still charging that that's the case. What would it mean if the rebels are actually using chemical weapons?
Well, this is part of the complication of the entire conflict to begin with, in that there is no one side here that people clearly see as an aggrieved party. Certainly 18 months ago, when there were peaceful protests in the southern Syrian town of Daraa, and the regime used force against them, there was clearly a sense of the Arab Spring coming to Syria, where peaceful protesters were out demanding fundamental kind of changes. Obviously, over the course of the last 2 months, there's been a significant change in the profile of what's going on in Syria. And indeed, if these reports are credible, that certain groups within the rebellion use sarin gas, it is yet another complicating factor, especially given I think the genuine desire among many to support legitimate elements within the rebellion that want to build a new and more just Syrian society. I think one of the reasons why the Obama administration has been careful on this question of chemical weapons, besides the fact that it is, as I said before, deeply reluctant to get involved in the conflict, is that there's been no indication that the Syrians have not maintained full control of their rather large stock of chemical weapons. So where rebel groups would find sarin gas remains a mystery to everybody.
Writing in the Atlantic Wire earlier this week, Dashiell Bennett said that this ongoing civil war and the ensuing international confusion and conflict over how to insert itself has put Syria exactly where Bashar al-Assad wants the country to be, in a continuing crisis. And the longer that crisis continues, the harder it will be for any one group to supplant his government. Do you agree with that?
Well, indeed. Once this conflict began, it has provided an opportunity for Assad to actually deal with a host of political problems that were just under the surface in Syria prior to the uprising. It does make it more difficult to contemplate a unified Syria without someone along the lines of Bashar al-Assad. There's tremendous talk of a democratic Syria, but of course, once Assad falls, that does not mean that the different factions that are fighting, including factions on the side of the regime, are going to come together in some way and build a new and more just society. There will be a continued conflict there for quite some time. So it is, in fact, hard to imagine at this point, Syria being imagining Syria in the same way that we've thought of Syria over the course, since the post World War I settlements. That's not an argument for support of the regime. It's just, I think, a statement of fact that the fundamental nature of Syria and what we think of Syria has changed as a result of this conflict and will likely continue to do so.
So to go back to how I introduced you, we're looking at the possibility of some kind of international conference on Syria. Is it possible to reach a successful diplomatic solution to what is happening there right now, do you believe?
Well, you know, never say never, and anything is possible. But right now, if you look at the structure of the conflict and the political interests of both the supporters of the regime and Bashar al-Assad himself, as well as the major factions within the rebellion, there's very little evidence to suggest that they are going to come together in some sort of fruitful negotiation. In fact, the one guy within the rebellion who had said we should contemplate negotiating with the regime was subsequently brought down by other factions within the regime. So this is really not a hopeful sign, although it does suggest that both the United States and the Russians are taking the consequences of the breakup of Syria as a result of this civil war more seriously.
In January, you wrote that you thought it was time for the Obama administration to do more, and I'm assuming more militarily. Do you still believe that that's the case?
I wrote that in January 2012. January 2012, at a time when Bashar al-Assad had only killed around 5,000 people. I felt that I never in my life have I been so upset to be so correct about something. But what I essentially said was that unless, if we were serious, if the United States was serious about Assad having to go, he was not going to go as a result of some sort of peaceful transition or diplomatic solution. That he was entrenched. He had people who were willing to sell him arms and people willing to pull the trigger on his behalf, and that many, many people were going to die unless we, the United States and allies, got involved militarily. That was January 2012, and I think that there was a principled position to take. Now it's a much different situation in Syria. We would essentially be intervening in someone else's civil war. I certainly believe we have the capability to do that, but I certainly believe that there are tremendous risks of getting involved in yet another Middle Eastern imbroglio, that the American people clearly have signaled that they're no longer interested in being in this part of the world.
Stephen Cook, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about this.
My great pleasure.
Dr. Stephen Cook is the Hasib J. Sabbagh Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This is Weekday on KUOW.
Senator Patty Murray talks about the issue of sexual assault in the military in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Irritable Bowel Syndrome Treatment Center, specializing in IBS, gluten sensitivity, celiac disease, and related digestive problems. Details on customized IBS solutions at IBSTreatmentCenter.com or on Facebook.
54 degrees in Seattle under a cloudy sky. Expecting sun this afternoon, though, with a high of 71. Tomorrow, clouds in the morning, then sunny again in the afternoon with a high of 75. A new study suggests that people with blast injuries are more likely to have irregular hormone levels, and that can negatively affect health. We're going to talk with the lead author of that study in about 10 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Washington Senior Senator Patty Murray and New Hampshire Republican Kelly Ayotte yesterday introduced a bill aimed at reducing sexual assaults in the military and helping victims of that crime. The bill was introduced on the same day the Pentagon issued its annual report on sexual assault. The report showed the number of military sexual assault cases rose dramatically between 2011 and 2012. Only about one-third of cases are actually reported. I reached Senator Murray by telephone late yesterday afternoon, and I asked her what the Combating Military Sexual Assault Act would actually do.
What it will do is protect our service members and assist our victims and punish the criminals. There's a number of provisions in our bill, but importantly, for the first time, it's going to provide our victims with special counsel. You know, right now, unbelievably, there is nobody protecting or advising the victims in this through a very difficult and horrible process they have to go through. And another provision that is really important is it eliminates the conflicts of interest among supervisors by moving these sexual assault cases to different jurisdictions when those conflicts arise. This has been a problem in the military all along. We do a number of other provisions, in particular with National Guard and Reserve, but this is a major step forward in combating an issue that is growing in numbers and one that cannot and should not be tolerated in our military.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned growing in numbers. The Pentagon report came out, and what we're seeing are huge numbers, and they're talking about at least a 10 to 12,000 incident increase between 2011 and 2012, but I was very surprised to see that only about a fourth of those were actually reported cases.
Yeah, that is one of the big challenges. There's about 26,000 cases of military sexual assault in 2012. Less than 3,000 of them were reported. That tells you that they lived in fear of retaliation. That tells you that they did not come forward to prosecute a crime. That tells you that they did not get the support they needed, and that is exactly why we're introducing this legislation.
How do these numbers that we're seeing, the increase in military assault cases, how do those numbers compare to what's happening in the civilian population?
I don't have the comparison in the civilian population, but I think when we know that 62% of those people who had military sexual assault, 62% of them said that they were retaliated against in what were retaliated against in one way or another. That is an extremely high number, and I'm pretty sure that does not happen in the civilian world.
Right. It is interesting to note that the bill was introduced just a couple days after the officer in charge of sexual assault prevention programs at the Air Force was himself arrested for sexual assault. How, if at all, does your bill address instances like that?
Well, the victim of the sexual assault on that case would then have a special victim's counselor to help her through the process, to give her the advice, legal advice that she needs in order to prosecute it. It means that the commanding officer would not be the one prosecuting the case, so that she would get a fair chance, and several other provisions that will help her out. But I think the other thing to really note with this, with yesterday's news about the Air Force Chief of Sexual Assault Prevention being arrested for sexual assault, we need to change the culture around this issue. This has to be a top commander down to the very bottom that this is not tolerated. Our legislation is extremely important in providing people protection, but the military itself has to not just talk about this in words, but give the actions and the clear direction that this will not be tolerated in the military.
Lastly, Senator, the bill was co-sponsored by Republican Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire. How much bipartisan support do you have for this?
Well, I am working with Kelly Ayotte. She is a Republican from New Hampshire. She and I have been working on this issue together. She and I actually began working on the Violence Against Women Act together. She's a prosecutor, former prosecutor, and has worked with victims of sexual assault, and she's on the appropriate military committees, and I have jurisdiction on the veterans committees. So she was the right partner for me, and she's really good on this, and I think we will have a lot of good bipartisan support moving forward.
And you also have a record number of female senators?
We do. We have 20 women senators, and I'll tell you, we are all fired up about this.
Anything else that you want to add about this, Senator?
Well, I think this is really an important major step forward in terms of sexual assault, and we are going to work very hard to get this bill passed, but we know Congress, it's not easy, so I expect the public to weigh in on this. I encourage the public to weigh in on this and to encourage their members of Congress to support it. We need to have this to be a high-profile, non-tolerated issue, and that's why I'm counting on public support.
Senator Murray, thank you so much. That's U.S. Senator Patty Murray. Yesterday, she and New Hampshire Republican Kelly Ayotte jointly introduced the Combating Military Sexual Assault Act. We're joined now by KUOW's Patricia Murphy. She covers military issues. And Patricia, you listened to the Pentagon press briefing yesterday about the military sexual assault numbers. Can you explain to us the scope of the problem?
Well, a lot of the sexual assault issue within the military, from what I understand from members of the military and people who follow these things, is specific to the structure of the military. Whenever you have a rank and file system where you have people who are above other people, there are avenues for intimidation and problems within that system. And often what I have heard is messages from the DOD regarding the
Department of Defense
regarding the unacceptability of this problem get diluted as they move through that rank and file system. So a lot of efforts don't always make it to the rank and file. And that's a big problem.
Patty Murray alluded to, in fact, she said straight out that a lot of the assaults do go unreported because the victims are afraid of some kind of retaliation, some kind of repercussion from supervising officers.
Absolutely. If you are a female officer, we'll just say, who is underage drinking with another military service member, and something goes badly that night and you report a sexual assault, you then can be charged with underage drinking. That is a huge problem. And that is something that is part of the Uniform Military Code of Justice. So that in itself is a problem and a deterrent to reporting.
Which is why we saw, I believe it was something like 26,000 cases, which were anonymously collected in this Pentagon study. And of that, I believe it was 3,400 or so were actual reports.
2,700 service members reported that they were sexually assaulted in 2012, and that is higher than in 2010 and 2011. But yes, it is generally accepted, and through those data surveys, that it's probably closer to 26,000.
They're very careful when they talk about this to talk about military assaults against military men and military women. Are we talking overwhelmingly assaults against women, or is there a significant percentage of men who are reporting these?
From my understanding from previous years of reporting, about 7% of military sexual assaults are involving men as the victim. And we reported on one when we did our series a couple of years back.
You mentioned when we started talking that the official military anti-sexual assault message gets diluted as it comes down the line. Patty Murray said that she believes the military needs a dramatic attitudinal shift towards sexual assault. First of all, does this bill that was introduced yesterday have address that at all?
A lot of the things that are included in this bill have been efforts that the Sexual Assault Prevention Response Office have been trying to implement. A lot of these things are on the book: stronger positions for advocates, the ability for command to not intimidate. These messages have been put out. There is no question that the Department of Defense is concerned. It's in the application of these things that it seems to get problematic.
Well, what do you imagine, just the last question, what do you imagine it would take for some kind of strong anti-sexual assault message at the rank and file level?
You know, it is such an inherent problem in the structure that it is just going to be so incredibly difficult. You know, it is just going to be so incredibly difficult to combat this problem.
KUW's Patricia Murphy covers military issues. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:31. We're going to learn about the effects of blast injuries on veterans' hormone levels in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Graham & Dunn, a full-service law firm focused on helping Northwest businesses tackle challenges faced on the path to success. Online at grahamdunn.com, located on Pier 70. Business law from a different point of view.
Cloudy and 54 degrees in Seattle, expecting it to be sunny and 71 this afternoon. Then it'll be partly cloudy overnight with a low of 53. Tomorrow, some clouds in the morning, then mostly sunny later with a high of 75.
Support for KUOW comes from the Community of Mindful Parents, a website for information about classes like Listening Mothers and Reflective Parenting, as well as interactive conversations exploring the mindful path to stress-free, happy, well-adjusted families. Information online at communityofmindfulparents.com.
Former NBA star Dennis Rodman sent out a tweet asking his friend, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, to release the Linwood man sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. We'll have more on this attempt at Twitter diplomacy in about 15 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. What does a concussion have to do with hormone deficiencies? A new study suggests quite a bit. Researchers from the University of Washington and the Department of Veterans Affairs Puget Sound Healthcare System studied 35 veterans who had blast injuries to the head. Almost half of these people had irregular hormone levels. What do these findings mean? Joining us now is Charles Wilkinson. He's a University of Washington research associate in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Studies, and he's the lead author of that new study. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Marcy. Thank you for inviting me to talk with you.
So these 35 veterans that you studied, what exactly were the kinds of injuries that they had sustained?
They had all had at least one blast concussion during deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan. Most of them had several blast concussions.
And what made you think that there would be hormone irregularities associated with these blast concussions?
If I can give you a little bit of background about the pituitary location, I can answer the question.
Sure.
Best. The pituitary is really vulnerable to brain injury. It's located at the base of the brain. It's about the size of a garbanzo bean, and it's connected to the brain by a very narrow stalk that's only about an eighth of an inch in diameter, and that stalk carries its nerve and major blood supply. And Also, the body of the gland is enclosed in a bony pocket. So in the case of a concussion where you've got rapid acceleration and deceleration of the brain within the skull, there are torsional or shearing forces acting on that narrow stalk, while the base of the gland is held stationary. That makes the stalk especially very vulnerable to damage. But up until about a dozen years ago, pituitary dysfunction after traumatic brain injury was thought to be extremely rare, and it hadn't really been studied at all. But beginning in about 2000, since then there have been about 30 studies that typically found a frequency of pituitary hormone deficiencies after TBI from a variety of causes, automobile accidents, sports injuries, falls. They found the prevalence to be from 25% to 50%. And considering that the frequency of hypopituitarism in the general population has been estimated at 0.04%, that's an enormous level.
So what hormones specifically are affected after a concussion?
The most common, I should say before, I'll answer that question in a minute, but I became interested in the problem because I do work for the Department of Veterans Affairs, and blast concussion is the single most common combat injury in Iraq and Afghanistan. But up until our study, nobody looked at the effects of blast concussion on pituitary function, so I realized it needed to be done. And to go on to your question.
Okay, no, thank you for clarifying that.
The most common deficiency that have been found, both in these 30 studies that I described and in our study, are related to growth hormone deficiency and deficiencies in the gonadotropins, the hormones that control reproduction and sexual function.
So growth hormone, why would that be a problem? They're already grown up.
That's true, and that's the reaction of most people. But it's been found that adult growth hormone deficiency has a number of serious consequences, especially on learning and memory and mood and some aspects of behavior. It's associated with depression, deficiencies in learning and memory, fatigue, social isolation, sleep disorders, and anxiety, irritability, pain, and general lowering of quality of life. These are symptoms that overlap considerably with PTSD. And several of those symptoms could also result from deficiencies in pituitary thyroid or pituitary adrenal systems, but we didn't see any abnormalities in those systems.
So are those symptoms that can be reversed or somehow ameliorated if you treat them?
That's an interesting question. In general, hormonal abnormalities can be treated successfully with hormone replacement, and that's the good thing about this, that these symptoms can generally be treated if they're diagnosed appropriately. But there is controversy about growth hormone replacement. It will affect, another effect of growth hormone deficiency is bone and muscle loss and increased fat deposits and lipid accumulation in the blood and hypertension and cardiovascular problems. Those latter problems can be addressed with growth hormone deficiency, but there's controversy about whether growth hormone replacement can address the mental and behavioral problems. Actually, a difference in my reading, there's a very different approach to that in Europe than there is in the U.S. There's a much greater reluctance to treat growth hormone deficiency here.
We're talking with Dr. Charles Wilkinson of the University of Washington. What do these studies of combat veterans tell you about hormone irregularities in civilians?
Based on the other studies that have been done, which the 30 studies that I mentioned, they were all done in civilians, I think it reinforces the idea that there are serious consequences. And the other studies were primarily concerned with more serious head injuries, skull fractures, and rather than concussion, which is used synonymously with the term mild traumatic brain injury, but whether or not it's very mild is is open to question. But a couple of those studies were done on boxers and kickboxers, people who've had repetitive severe impacts to their heads, and they had very severe, especially growth hormone deficiencies. And so I think there's obviously a lot more work needs to be done, but I think it's something that should be studied more in relation to sports concussions, which is a very big area in the news lately. And I'm a member of a group of researchers, and each of us is leading a separate and interrelated aspects of studies and interrelated aspects of concussion. And Dr. Elaine Peskind is the leader of the group, and she and Dr. Kathleen Pagilayan are leading studies of sports concussion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an area that our group is addressing. And I'm going to be doing hormone measurements in conjunction with their studies.
This original study, as I understand it, was published last year. Mm-hmm. Have you found new data that warranted a press release about it this week?
What we've found is we've expanded and extended the study, and we've found confirmation of our original results. We are going to be expanding the study into different approaches, but that's what's described in the press release, is just an expansion of the original study.
So at this point in time, it sounds like you've got this data. You really are at the point where you just need to expand it out. And so that is what the plan is, to just keep looking at it, both in veterans, sports concussions, various aspects of how some kind of brain injury would affect our hormonal levels.
That's part of it. One of my primary goals is just to get the word out about this underappreciated aspect of head injuries. And one thing we're going to do, there's some problems with screening, especially for growth hormone, because most physicians would consider that you need a provocative test to really diagnose growth hormone deficiency. And that's one thing that I need to mention, that our study is a study of screening. It's a study of measurement of basal hormone levels, and low levels unless there's symptoms associated with them, low levels don't necessarily mean that there's a significant problem, and that's something that needs to be addressed by clinical evaluation by an endocrinologist, and we're not doing that. But to go on with what I started to say, provocative testing is just using some sort of stimulus that really stimulates the system, and in a normal person would provoke a really high growth hormone response. In individuals with a deficiency, there is no response. But that's a procedure that takes close medical supervision. It's expensive. It is very unpleasant for patients. So what we're trying to do, our long-range goal, is to investigate a lot of other measures like lipid levels in the blood, body composition, neuropsychological testing, and try to come up with a combination of measures that can reduce the need for provocative testing in terms of pointing to those individuals who would benefit from clinical evaluation.
I know you're a researcher, sort of pure scientific researcher, but if somebody had say a sports concussion and started experiencing some of the symptoms that might be correlated with some of these hormone deficiencies, would you recommend that they go to their doctor and say, hey, this is going on?
Absolutely. One characteristic of these abnormalities is that there's after a head injury, like any kind of injury, there are going to be some immediate hormonal consequences just due to the injury. But the problems that we're looking at are chronic. After a period of time, the initial hormone deficiencies, some of them would resolve. Some new ones might appear. But after several months to a year, the abnormalities are relatively permanent, and that's what we're interested in. So I would say that if someone has persistent symptoms that last for, let's say, a year, then they should seriously consider evaluation. Because if the symptoms are not recognized as endocrine system symptoms, they're not going to be treated appropriately. And that's the message we want to get out, is that this is an area that needs to be receive greater appreciation by the public and the medical community.
Charles Wilkinson, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Charles Wilkinson is lead author of a new study on the impact of blasts to the head on hormone levels. The study was jointly conducted by the University of Washington and the Department of Veteran Affairs. This is Weekday. In his first diplomatic act since his visit to North Korea earlier this year, NBA Hall of Famer Dennis Rodman is using his friendship with North Korea's Kim Jong-un to ask for the release of a Linwood man. Earlier this month, North Korea's Supreme Court convicted Kenneth Bae of hostile acts against the government and sentenced him to 15 years hard labor. This week, Rodman took to Twitter to ask Kim to, quote, do me a solid and cut Kenneth Bae loose. Seattle Times editorial writer Tan Tan first tweeted to Dennis Rodman to urge him to get involved. She joins us now. Hello. Thanks for being with us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Maybe you want to walk us back a few months to Kenneth Bae's release. Who is he, and why did North Korea detain him?
Well, Kenneth Bae is a tour operator. He's from Linwood, Washington, but according to news reports and his sister, who was interviewed last week in the media, he's been living in China with his wife. He guides tours into North Korea. Apparently, he has a strong relationship with the people there. He loves the country, he says. He loves the people. So he was taking a group of businessmen or business people over across the border back in November, and apparently while he was doing that, he was detained. And, you know, reports have kind of varied the country. North Korea has not been very specific about this, but supposedly they say he's responsible for hostile acts against their country, which is why they've sentenced him to 15 years of hard labor.
Now, I know that the Times in general, Seattle Times, has supported calls for Bae's release on humanitarian reasons. How did you get involved in this whole thing?
Well, since December, we've definitely been interested in trying to track this issue because he is a local person. He has family members here in Washington. So the Seattle Times editorial board has written three editorials now, two really encouraging the State Department to try to pursue diplomatic channels to find out what has happened to him. Last week, the State Department came out and said, you know, these charges are pretty much ridiculous, and so he should be released on humanitarian grounds, and so we've supported that position. And, you know, as a result of the U.S. not having a formal relationship with North Korea, we know that Swedish diplomats have had some access to Kenneth Bae, but, you know, the reason why I got involved in trying to directly challenge Dennis Rodman to do something was because we know that he's actually somebody who has somewhat of a legitimate relationship with Kim Jong-un. There's photos of them, you know, acting like buddies throughout the country, watching a basketball game. Dennis Rodman has been talking about his plans to go back to North Korea in August. So, you know, if the president, the State Department, Eric Schmidt, CEO or chairman of Google, you know, if those type of people can't get access to Kenneth Bae and get the country to release him, perhaps Kim Jong-un's personal friend here, friend for life, supposedly, can do something about that. So that was the reason why I sent the tweet out and wrote the blog post issuing the challenge.
Tan Tan is with us. She's Seattle Times multimedia editorial writer. Did you think that that Dennis Rodman would actually follow through? Were you serious about this?
Well, I was serious about this. I mean, I'm a student of international relations. I studied this in college, but, you know, I really didn't know. I mean, we all know Dennis Rodman has quite the personality. He's got quite the ego, you know, and I think he's using this to his advantage in some ways, but I do think he's trying to do something good, you know, with his notoriety, and I was hoping that he would respond. I have to say I was pretty shocked. I was working on another editorial yesterday, happened to have TweetDeck open and saw this tweet, and and was even more surprised when he said that, you know, it's like this is a direct result of me seeing your headline. So good for him. Good for Dennis Rodman.
Well, it's interesting because North Korea officially has said that they're not going to engage in any kind of diplomatic humanitarian releases. Both former President Carter and former President Clinton have had occasion to travel on behalf of U.S. citizens who've been detained by the North Koreans. And this time North Korea says, no, we're not going to fall for it. So why would Dennis Rodman have an impact if Bill Clinton or Jimmy Carter couldn't?
Well, I think, first of all, because he's met this new leader, because you're right, there is sort of a paradigm shift here. This is not Kim Jong-il, you know, it's his son. But I think that, you know, first of all, like I said, Dennis Rodman is planning to go back to North Korea in August. Whether he actually means that, I'm really not sure. But I think that, you know, if we focus on the politics here, I heard Kenneth Bay's sister, Terry Chung, talk on CNN, in an interview last week, and she said she's so worried about her brother being caught up in the politics of this, you know, and what is going on with North Korea and their nuclear ambitions and their efforts to try to get to provoke the U.S. and the international community to lift sanctions, to help them out, provide them with humanitarian aid. I think if we sort of shift away from that and focus on what are the common interest here, and it seems so strange, it seems so simple, but it's basketball. You know, you have a family here and a supreme leader who loves basketball, loves the Chicago Bulls. If we can use that to our advantage, if Dennis Rodman can use that to his advantage to get this man freed, then why not try it? But again, I don't know if it's going to work. Who knows? But
yeah, certainly not us. It would be interesting to watch basketball diplomacy. I guess there's one further thing that I'd like to talk about, and that is social media and where that has taken us. We saw in the Arab Spring what happened with Facebook and Twitter and how it was used to organize massive groups of people. You know, you reached out on Twitter seriously, but it does show something about not just paradigm shifts of diplomacy, but also paradigm shifts of communication.
Absolutely. I think that's a point that's been brought up. A lot of people have asked me about this or tweeted or mentioned this, you know, on Twitter. So I get it. And, you know, we'll see if it works. I think what makes this situation sort of unique, again, is we're dealing with a country that is incredibly secretive. They don't have internet freedom there. The big question is, does Kim Jong-un even know that his friend Dennis Rodman has made this request to him? And, you know, the country does have an official Twitter feed, but I don't think they update it very often. And so, you know, this is part of the social media community. What do we do? You know, the next step is how do we make sure that this message is getting across to see if it might make a difference? But, you know, I would certainly, I'd love to see basketball diplomacy, social media diplomacy, and Twitter diplomacy work in this case.
That's interesting. So there's an official Twitter feed from the North Korean government, but nobody knows if Kim Jong-un is checking his iPhone every day or whatever phone.
I don't know if he's checking it. It doesn't say that it's the official account. I mean, it's just different news accounts have said that this one particular one is, and it hasn't been updated in days. And so it's hard to know, but I mean, I have to think that I don't know if Kim Jong-un himself is following Dennis Rodman's tweets, but you have to think that, you know, they do monitor coverage of their country, and apparently they're not very happy about, you know, news reports that they've heard recently that they're trying to leverage Kenneth Bay to try to, you know, get a high-level envoy, U.S. envoy, to come and visit them. They're rejecting that and denying that.
Right.
So, you know, maybe we can use social media to our advantage and not to say that, you know, hey, we want to be your friend, but, you know, try to, again, focus on the common interest on, you know, Dennis Rodman and sports.
It just occurs to me he probably doesn't have an iPhone. He probably has a Samsung Galaxy, even though it's made in South Korea. What's the next step for you personally for your involvement in all of this? Is your work done?
No, I think I'm trying to follow this on Twitter, following Dennis Rodman. He hasn't tweeted since yesterday. So I tried to respond to him. I said, hey, thanks for engaging. Let me know if your friend actually does respond to you. And it's sort of a waiting game. So I'm just going to be on TweetDeck or Twitter all day, I think, and just trying to monitor, you know, the developments. But it's starting to get a lot of coverage also from different media outlets around the country and around the world. And so I think that, you know, this is not over yet. We'll see.
The power of a tweet. Tan Tan, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me.
Thank you.
Tan Tan's a multimedia editorial writer at the Seattle Times, and she shouted out via Twitter to NBA Hall of Famer Dennis Rodman to use his friendship with North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un to ask for the release of Linwood man Kenneth Bay. And Rodman's Twitter to Kim was, "Do me a solid and cut Kenneth Bay loose." You can see the whole exchange at the Seattle Times website. And now, the sound of the day. Anybody want to guess what that is? Kind of difficult. That is the sound of a handful of pebbles that are being tossed across the iced over water of the Arboretum this past winter. Our listener Nina sent us that sound. She recorded it while she was on her way to Foster Island, I assume walking.
Kind of mysterious sound.
Yeah, does it sound like pebbles to you, Bernard?
No. It sounds like maybe wires whipping in the wind or something.
You know, I wonder if there are any musical composers listening, because we've had a couple of sounds this week that could almost be incorporated into some kind of nature composition. That's one, don't you think?
Definitely.
I like that.
Let's see if we can get somebody to do that and
okay.
Then send it to us.
I know that there are musicians listening, so perhaps we can work together. That'll be our latest shout out. And perhaps I should have checked with the producers before I did that. Amina Al-Sadi says, yeah. What interesting sounds are you listening to? They could be as melodic as this, or perhaps like the snoring pug dog yesterday. Record 30 seconds of what you are hearing and send that sound to us along with the story behind it. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org with sound of the day in the subject line. And I'm just going to shout out again. Maybe you want to make a beautiful musical composition out of that. Coming up in the next hour of Weekday, we're going to be talking about the long-awaited release of Baz Luhrmann's Great Gatsby. Robert Horton has seen not only a 3D version of a 1920s, roaring 20s story, but with music updated by Jay-Z. Hard to imagine what that is all like, Bernard, but, you know, kind of anachronistic.
Yes, you could say that.
I could say that. Robert's not quite taken with it, but we're going to talk about what happens when you try to update historical sort of costume dramas with modern day music, perhaps a sensibility. Obviously, we're looking at things with a 21st century sensibility.
Is this movie in 3D?
It is in 3D. The Great Gatsby in 3D.
So it's in 3D and it's got music by Jay-Z.
Uh-huh. And so you might have read The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald in school, a book that's often assigned. Maybe people would like it a whole lot more if, you know, they had a backbeat.
If Jay-Z was in there somewhere.
Yeah. I'm not sure he's in the movie, but that's something to talk about. Also, Michael Parks talking about Windows 8 and whether Microsoft is backpedaling. And Vaughn Palmer, as always, next week, British Columbia holds elections. So that is coming up. And of course, if you missed any portion of the show after noon today, you probably find the whole audio file at kuow.org/weekday. Looking forward to next hour, Bernard. And I'm looking forward to, I see that you've got a computer monitor open, a big television in front of you, and the sun has not yet burst forth.
That is true. It's still cloudy outside, as far as I can tell.
But you've promised me that it's going to be sunnier.
I feel strongly that it will turn sunny this afternoon, yes.
You said it yesterday.
Yes.
And it
happened.
And it happened, so you must have the power.
There you go.
I give it to you.
I'm tapped in to the National Weather Service.
And thank goodness.
Yeah, they're telling us it is going to be sunny this afternoon with a high of 71, some clouds overnight and tomorrow morning, and then sunny again tomorrow afternoon with a high of 75. It's 9:58 now. Wind farm construction has been booming over the last few years here in the Northwest, but not this year. We're going to find out why in the news in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Vitreo Retinal Associates of Washington, announcing the opening of a new office in Montlake Terrace to serve patients from Snohomish and North King counties with retinal problems such as macular degeneration. More at VRAWashington.com.
As many as 35% of college students illicitly take stimulants such as Adderall or Ritalin to focus during finals. That's according to the National Center for Biotechnology. Have you ever taken Adderall or some other stimulant to help you finish your homework or maybe get through your job? Do you take stimulants illegally to help you focus? We're preparing to talk about that later today at noon, and we'd love to hear your story right now. Give us a call, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. Do you illicitly use stimulants and why? We're taking that up today at noon. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs at Chapman University, located in Orange County, California, offering master's or doctoral programs in six different colleges. Accreditation and graduate admission information at chapman.edu/graduate degree.
Salman Rushdie wrote his novel Midnight's Children about Indians born just as their nation became
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.